welcome to Heavy Potter's Heavy Cast, episode 177. I don't know why I did like a edgy voice, but hey.
What's up?
Like, subscribe. This week's podcast is sponsored by Heavy Blog is Heavy.
Oh, that's a really cool site, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they're paying us, so I can't really say anything bad about it, but...
Yeah, they're bankrolling us with a little big metal bucks.
Big metal energy.
Sure, if you say so.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I'm a bit out of it this week. I'm moving places on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. It's like really fast and unexpected. I've been living in the same apartment for 8 years. On and off. So, and I was expecting to move, but like 3 months. So it all like crept up on me. That's it. My entire house is like in boxes and shit. So,
would you say that you're trading places?
What's the joke here?
It's a famous movie.
Oh, featuring I know the movie.
Eddie Murphy.
I was looking.
You said
for...
you're moving places. So I'm like trading places. Yeah, that's a joke.
Hello.
Big brain jokes, brother.
Big galaxy joke time. Like Dave Chappelle. Who was being censored on his Netflix special.
That's me going like a heater boiling pot thing.
Like the angry character from Inside Out.
Angry character? That's
a movie.
I haven't seen that movie. Yes,
you
that
haven't?
Is a movie. No.
It's a good movie.
Animated movies are for children, man.
You only play serious video games. Wait, no, that's...
Oh. That's... okay, the listener has no idea what we're talking about.
Nope.
But, okay.
Nope. But that's our brand by now, right? Like, confusing our listeners with inside jokes.
Right. Speaking of, like,
memes.
Confusing, funny memes. So we talked about this YouTube channel before, Melodica Bros. Right. They did, like, the really cool Trivium acoustic medley.
Yep.
I've been following them. Like, I don't know. It's not that they're doing anything like super special, but like their brand of weird goofy is just exactly my kind.
Right.
They usually do like acoustic covers, but this one, they do a cover of Slipknot's Duality. And as in going with the title of the song, it's like a dual cover where they like one part is like a pretty straightforward cover.
Yeah.
But the other part is like a happy acoustic cover like they usually do on their channel. And they keep going back and forth between them. And the juxtaposition is kind of funny. And at the end, they like bring it together. So they like a happy metal version cover of it. And it's super cool. I just really love this channel.
I think it's just, like you said, it's like a classic gag, right? This like metal in a major key or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're so irreverent and they just don't give a shit and they have fun with it.
And like they do it so well. Like there's so many channels that do this type of thing, but like they always feel like super low effort. Oh, I play the exact same song, but in like a major key, and that's it. Like there's a channel that does this for like a bunch of Trivium songs, and I just like don't really like it.
Yeah.
But these guys, like the energy that these guys bring is just perfect, right?
Yep.
It's
good memes, bro.
Yeah, good memes. And they also have, like, an acoustic... By the way, they do, like, serious acoustic covers as well. Like, not a major key, but, like, just straightforward.
Yeah.
Their acoustic cover of Periphery's Marigold, I enjoy a lot more than the original song, and I already love the original song.
Yeah. They're cool.
Right.
Check them out.
Yes. Speaking of other, like, upbeat, weird shit, fucking Jacob Collier, man.
How is this man... real and like you know the meme what a time to be alive, like you got to be alive and you're sharing time with Jacob Collier. I legitimately unironically feel that way.
So this, like it's a live video he posted on his channel of him playing With the Love in My Heart live in Toronto. So this song is like
makes amazing.
Galaxy Brain seem like small brain in terms of like how dense and
the
complex it is. And I was like,
go ahead.
I was like, when I saw this in my feed, I was like, there's no way this song works live, right? Like, you can't translate this to like a live stage because of how intense it is. But like, not only does he do it, he just like takes in a completely different direction where like he brings in the crowd to the song.
Yeah.
Like, he makes the crowd like sing it, but like, as not as just, you know, normally, like, you know, when the rock band does it, like, oh, the vocalist doesn't sing and they just like the crowd does a song because the vocalist like can't do that high note anymore.
Right.
It's not like that here. Like, he orchestrates the crowd, like he makes them do harmonies and like he controls the crowd. And then he's like running between all the instruments, like plays the keyboard, goes to the piano, plays some drums, goes to the bass. Like, he's ridiculous. Like, what the fuck is this man?
Yeah, it's insane. And I think for me, the reason, one of the reasons that made this so special is I really like crowds singing. And in mm-hmm. general, the idea of like group singing. And I think mm-hmm. it comes down to like, if I'm going to take this in a much deeper direction than maybe you planned. But like in Judaism, singing songs is like a really important part of almost every holiday, right?
Sure.
There's a lot of folk songs that will pass down over the years, especially like quote unquote our Christmas, Hanukkah.
Hava Nagila.
Yeah, exactly. Hava Nagila is like more of a generic one.
I know. It's just a meme, right?
Yeah, but like for Hanukkah, it's my favorite Jewish holiday. I love the aesthetic. It's really metal. It's all about like fire and fighting back the dark and shit like that. And
also, you enjoy the Hanukkah gifts I gave you?
Oh, I love them. We're taking them with us when we move. we're going to put them on the window. And some of the songs are intricate. You know, like some of them are simple, you know, just folk songs. But some of them have like multiple voices and mm-hmm. funny stuff with like how, you know, the harmonies fit in and stuff like that. And in general, like if you expand it, I really like this idea of, you know, when a crowd sings, obviously it sounds harmonic, right?
Yeah.
Because the inconsistencies get averaged out, right?
I feel like this is kind of hard for like a very Anglo-centric audience to appreciate, but like in Balkan and like Middle Eastern cultures, it's yeah. like a really big part of the culture.
Right. But I think also when you listen to crowds sing when they sing songs, like for, like modern songs, like think yeah. of the like legendary Fear of the Dark recording mm-hmm. by Iron Maiden, where they're singing the whoa, that famous part yep. of Fear of the Dark, like how everything gets kind of averaged out and people become amazing singers by virtue of the collective.
Yep.
And I think it's really interesting. So here, when he started doing it, I was kind of worried the first time I saw it because you're not going to try and get them to sing microtones like you do, right? Because yeah. no one can fucking do that. I was just listening to Jesse Volume 2 and on, mm-hmm. what was it, Sky Above, where he does these like microtone harmonies and it's just insane. But then he just does really cool things with the audience and you hear and you see in the people's faces how much they enjoy suddenly having their voices amplified. I don't know. It's just something that's really special to me and I really like live shows because of this. Mm-hmm. I really like when bands like do interesting stuff with it. And he does.
I really dislike it in the sense that most bands just kind of do it lazily. Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to sing the chorus here. And then that kind of takes away from the song. But when it's done, like you said, like Iron Maiden or Jacob Collier, like it's amazing. And like, this is just like next level.
Next
like,
level. He does the entire song by himself. Basically, he's like the entire band
running around the stage. Like,
yeah, I remember like, when I saw, Transatlantic, you know, mm-hmm. Mike Portnoy, Neil Morse, all those guys. And they do a medley where they, I think I spoke about this on the podcast.
Yeah.
They like change instruments, but this is just one guy doing it. So it's insane.
Yeah. Like Jacob is like so next level that like he's like skipped like several levels ahead and like he's, it's just mind blowing. Just go watch this video. Like even if you're not into like his music, this video is just like out of this world.
Yep. It's amazing.
It's ridiculous. I don't want to go into the Iron Maiden thing right now. We have some like positive energy. Let's keep going.
Sure.
Speaking of positive energy, keep going. There's no segue here, but there's a new Nile song.
Yeah, they have a positive energy and they keep going, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, like Nile is one of my favorite bands. I fucking love Nile so much. So of course, when Dallas Toller Wade left, I was super, super anxious about what that meant for the future of the band. Because, like, he has been pretty key to their sound ever since In Their Darkened Shrines, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Like, not just his voice, but also his, like, you know, guitar playing. I think, like, he made the band better.
Yeah, super iconic.
And when he left, you know, I was like, okay, like, to be fair, like, the last Nile album before he left was kind of not super interesting. But when he left, you know, it could be that, oh, like, the last album he wasn't committed and now that he's gone it's like going completely off the rails, or you know, maybe they just needed some fresh blood. So they got what's the guy's name, Brian Parsons, I think, from Entheon, mm-hmm. and to replace him. And like I saw them live with Brian, or like whatever that new guy's name is, and they were super amazing. Like he had huge shoes to fill and he did fill them. I even talked about it in the podcast a couple of years ago. So they have a new album coming up in November called Vile Nihilotic Rites, which I love that they're just full on embracing the meme at this point.
Yeah.
And this new song is Long Shadows of Dread.
Yeah.
And it's pretty good.
It's not good.
I wouldn't say it's one of their best songs, but it's up there in terms of like, this is basically what they've been doing for like the last few albums and like a good example of it, kind of bringing it together. It has like the long off time runs from what was the one after those are the guys, I think it's the one that's underrated that I super love, the one with the crocodile song.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, but I can never remember the album names.
Yeah, they're ridiculous. I'll look it up in the meantime. And has some of the like super extreme harshness from the What Should Not Be on Earth, which was their last album. The album I'm thinking of is At the Gate of Sethu. I really like that album. And it has some of the like pure death metal vibe from Those Whom the Gods Detest. So it's like pretty good. And obviously the iconic Dallas voice is kind of missing, but the other guy, by the way, his name is Brian Indeed, I think. Let me see. Yes, Brian Kingsland. He has a different voice, but it still fits. It works.
Yeah.
And overall, I think this is a really solid song, and I'm excited for Vile Nihilotic Rites, which, by the way, like, the song titles on this are absolutely stupid. Like, the one of them was titled, like, The Oxford Handbook on something genocide, Savage Genocidal Warfare.
Amazing. I think for me, I was sold right off the bat with this track because that main riff is just so energetic and bouncy. And that's what I love about these guys. They could have easily gone towards the, oh, this is our stripped down album, right? And still made like something heavy, but more contemplative and slower and kind of like more posty. But instead they're like, no, we're Nile. We're just going to keep playing these really big, hooky death metal riffs, and it works. You know, obviously they're all like very experienced with production and recording and composition, so they just know how to hit the right notes, right?
Yep.
It always sounds great. It's not gonna like blow your mind. You're not gonna say, whoa, death metal in 2019 is so amazing, but it's good for what it does. And that's,
I think, it's still more interesting than like 99% of death metal out there today.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, it's not always the case that the original like outplays the copy or the homage. But I think with old school death metal, like, I'll give you another example. Mithras completely destroyed every single band that tried to do their sound, right? They just came back and they were like, oh, we're doing this now. Let me remind you how to do this again. But then other like old school bands, I don't think the Origin album was good. Right?
Yeah.
Even though a lot of people are jocking their sound, I think they're not relevant anymore. But I think in Nile's case, it's totally
to
like,
be fair, the Origin album, the latest one, was literally just a remake of their old stuff. So
yeah, that's true. That's true.
The actual latest, like, original new album that they had was pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's true. Anyway.
But I think, you know what? Maybe a controversial example, but like the latest Obscure, right?
Yeah.
Progressive death metal, like very atmospheric progressive stuff, has been, I think, they're no longer leading their field. But here, it's like this note-centric, a lot is going on, very aggressive, very fast death metal that a lot of people are playing, like Vitriol and Hate Eternal and bands like that. Nile still do it very well.
Yep.
Yep.
For sure. Snake Pit Mating Frenzy is one of the song titles. And one last word. Like, the previous few albums have been criticized for, like, having a really thin production tone. So, like, the normal reaction here would be to kind of even out the harshness of the thin sound and, like, just have a more balanced sound. Now, and fuck it. And on this album, they just, like, also cranked the low end as well. So it's, like, obnoxious in every way possible. And I love it. Like,
they are just, works, like, though. The sound works.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I even when it was like just thin, I thought it still worked, and this just works even more. Like, I just love how Nile is just like 100% like
it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Speaking of note century cool death metal prog whatever things, the new Gone in April album is out,
right?
So Gone in April is a super underrated band, so let me set the stage here a little bit. There used to be this really cool technical death metal band called Quo Vadis.
Also underrated.
They used to play like basically Melodeath with thrash elements and like, but like a twice the speed of like regular Melodeath. And they were super, super cool. But they kind of fell apart. And they, one of the most, like, the two important characteristics of the band was that A, Steve DiGiorgio was on bass, and
very
B,
important.
Their drummer, Yannick Bercier, who was, by the way, has a physics PhD, is like one of the most interesting drummers in metal. Like, his style is super, super interesting. Like,
yeah, very unique.
He will take, like, the most generic average thrash riff and turn it into some really cool, interesting riff that completely recontextualizes it.
I think he, like, muddles the line between fills and playing the beat. He does them at the same time, somehow.
Yes.
Like, he keeps the beat, but he's filling in between the note. It's insane. He's so fast and accurate, and it has feel as well. It's not like a machine or whatever.
Yep. Like, he is so groovy while being fast. Like, I think he's, like, one of probably two drummers, I would say, that is super fast and still groovy, and the other one is George Kalaias.
Oh, yeah. Well, what a coincidence.
So, anyway, then members of this band, including one of the guitar players, Yannick and Steve, went to form Gone in April, where the difference is they got a new vocalist like for the screaming vocals, and they also got Julie Bélanger-Roy. She's in like a few smaller bands. She does the clean vocals and also plays violin. Nice. And like the violin is like a big part of the sound. It's not just like, you know, here or here and there. So they had an album a few years back, I think in 2016.
17? No?
Maybe.
Maybe you're right.
2016, yes. 2011, 2016, right. And now 2019. So their new album, Shards of Light, is out, and it's super, super good. Like, their sound is pretty consistent, but, like, nobody else is doing something like this, where they've taken, like, the Quo Vadis super fast melodeath sound, but then added, like, really operatic female singing, like, most, even, like, other metal bands with, like, more kind of epic vibes don't do like to this level of operatic singing, plus like heavy usage of violins in like a tech death context, and it's really interesting, and it's super, super good and super underrated.
I think
go listen to Shards of Light by Gone in April. It's amazing.
I also like this album. I don't love it yet because I just haven't spent enough time with it.
It's pretty dense.
It's dense, and there's so much music being released. But I listened to it seriously, like end to end for the first time today, and I really liked it. It's just, imagine if 15 years ago Epica and Camelot decided to actually do something with their sound instead of release the same album over and over again, and they like looked outside for influences, and they saw Arch Enemy, and they said, yeah, that could work, and they kind of meshed Camelot and Arch Enemy together.
And then played it like 1.5 times faster.
Yeah, like super fast. Yeah. Just go listen to it. It's really unique. If you like, you know, epic symphonic singing, but you're kind of tired of the whole power metal, goth metal vibes, right? Then this is for you.
Or if you're into like tech death, but you want like a different take on it, right?
Right. Definitely.
Yeah. Gone in April. Super, super amazing. Super amazing.
So, I want to segue from here to an item that I just added to the agenda.
Okay.
And I want to sell you on it. It's like not your style, but it is your style. So it's a project called Weeping Souls. And it goes like this.
Do not search this on YouTube.
Yeah, don't do that. Search it on Bandcamp. So it's the vocalist of Piron, Doug Moore.
Oh, Doug.
Doug, right, and the guitarists of Piron, and also Seputus, which is a project they have, working together with a really good violinist, whom you know because she's also the bass player for Technoborg, or however you pronounce that band's
Chernobog.
Name. Chernobog, exactly. And together, they made an album that is one half, and that's the part that's not your thing, doom metal, one half morbid angel worship, with violin, and Doug Moore doing his thing on vocals. So part of it is like really slow and contemplative, and part of it is very rooted in like old school death metal, but like the Morbid Angel variety, right? Not the tech death variety. And it has the amazing and disturbing, you know, guttural vocals that Doug does, and really interesting guitar writing and composition. And the violin is like baked into it, right? It's not just like now a violin break, right? It's like part of the composition, part of the work. And I'm not sure you'd like it, but you'll find it interesting for sure. It's a really interesting experiment. So give it a try. And if you're listening and any of this sounds appealing to you, I also wrote a review on it, which like digs deeper into why it works and how it does what it does. It's really interesting. Like at parts, you can hear kind of like what Alkaloid do, where suddenly the Morbid Angel riff comes in. So some parts of it, you're like, oh, that's Morbid Angel. But then it does really interesting stuff with it. And it doesn't have a lot of the usual failures of doom metal. Like it keeps things
being
fresh,
boring.
Yeah. It doesn't do repetition a lot and it doesn't do feedback and all that stuff. Give it a chance. I think you'd like it.
Okay. In other news, of similarly like weird elements in metal, like we have the Shaped in Dreams album and it's really cool.
Yeah.
I was kind of scared that, you know, the teaser was really cool, but like maybe the teaser was that's it, right? Like maybe they blew their load there, but no, I mean, the whole album is really cool. I really love kind of, it's literally just, okay, so I love old school metal death, right? Like Dark Tranquillity is what I fucking love. Haven is one of my favorite albums.
I just punched my microphone. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's fine. And In Flames, you know, I love In Flames as well. But like over time, that sound kind of became played out, right? And I've always wanted for like artists to kind of take the sound up and develop it further. And there's been bands that kind of, you know, did a little bit. I mean, Quo Vadis and like Gone in April is a little bit of that. Beyond Creation is a little bit of it. But like Beyond Creation doesn't really capture the kind of folky, grand vibe of it. And another artist like Black Crown Initiate a little bit at times. But like no artist like fully does it. And I think that Shaped in Dreams is like album is more of that to than any other band that I've heard. You know, it really embraces the kind of aesthetic of Dark Tranquillity, mid-era Dark Tranquillity that I don't think anybody else has really captured. Yeah. And the album is really cool. Like, it's interesting, you know, it keeps going in different directions and it has a bunch of things that constantly keep the songs fresh. You know, there's like a French horn section in one of the songs that's really cool, and there's like a bunch of different singers and, you know, all that stuff is cool.
I also like the album, but to give like maybe a contrast a bit to what you were saying, I agree with everything you said. I do think that it feels like a debut, right? Or like a project kind of understanding where it wants to go. I think it could have benefited from some editorial oversight. And like not, I wouldn't cut any track, but some parts in the middle, kind of feel excessive. Like it's trying to do so many things at the same time that at some point your ear is like just kind of zones out. And then there are like interesting parts where your ear like jumps back and it's like, oh yeah, this is really good. But a lot of it, the connective tissue could have been more efficient, I guess is the word I would use. It's still good, don't get me wrong, right? It's a good release and the ambition is like very impressive.
Yeah, and I think I can definitely forgive that in an initial release, and I would actually I respect that, and that gives the artist kind of, you know, ways to figure out like where to go.
Yeah, room to grow.
Yeah. I would rather like I acknowledge that this is not this is a criticism, right? I'm not trying to like excuse it, but I would rather an artist like try too many things and some of them fail than not trying enough things and it still fails.
I think that's, I totally agree with you. And I think that's why when we call out those like excellent, excellent debut albums is when they somehow manage to pull both things off at the same time. Right? Mm-hmm. They manage to have this unbridled ambition and yet still be energetic and incisive. Like the example that comes to my head is, of course, now it fucking flew out of my head.
Safety Fire Grand guy. The Ocean.
Yeah, Dave Wu, the guy who plays guitar.
Cyborg Octopus.
Cyborg Octopus, right? Like, they tried to do so many things and they pulled it off, right? Yep. And they still sounded like essential and energetic. And again, don't get me wrong, this is a great release. That's just the only thing, as I've been listening to it over the past few days, sometimes I found myself like zoning out during the middle of it. But then I always came back and got pulled back by the interesting influences and stuff like that. So definitely check it out if you're a fan of like progressive, metal dev, whatever, all that space.
Yep. Safety Fire Grand the Ocean, I think, is also like a perfect debut.
Dude, Safety Fire is like the perfect band. Except they no longer exist. It's a small flaw in the plan.
Speaking of artists that try too little and still don't manage to do a great job.
Yeah.
So we've heard the new Leprous album.
Right. Well, you could have gone. Fair. You could have gone the other way, right? You could have spoken about this as well.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah.
So to be fair, I think this is the best album Leprous have made since Coal.
Yeah.
Which Below is the song. Pit Falls is the new Leprous album coming up next month. So the thing is, there's definitely some interesting ideas in each song. It's just that some of the songs are just, you know, one idea that is kind of drawn out and doesn't have enough, like, momentum to keep going. And I feel like Leprous are just trying to be a different band now. Like, they used to be this band of, like, big epic moments and some progressive stuff thrown in and a little bit of weirdness and just big powerful, and they just don't do that anymore, and they're kind of more subdued, more drawn back, and it's just more atmospheric and more kind of indie sad boy vibes, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just not for me, right? Because, like, the first four albums, like three albums and whatever Silent Waters was, were just so over the top and so powerful that...
Why do I keep punching my mic?
Calm down, bro.
Dude, I'm so rattled right now.
It's just disappointing for me, right? It's just not what I want from the band. And I think part of it is because Isan's no longer producing their albums. Like, Isan's production was, I think, a big part of their sound. And Isan... Right, he produced Coal. He produced Coal, Bilateral, and let me see if he produced also Tall Poppy. It doesn't say. No, it's not Tall Poppy. So Bilateral and Coal were produced by Isan, and you can really tell, like, Isan's style is in there. And sorry, actually, I'm wrong. Apparently, Coal was Isan, Bilateral is Jens Bogren, just like Congregation.
Oh, interesting.
But, like,
that's why Coal is the best.
Yeah, for sure. And also, that's like, Congregation is when they stopped being Isan's backing band, right?
Right. I mean, for
those who don't know, Einar's sister is married to Isan, and Leprous used to be Isan's live band.
Literally, not a joke. Not a joke. Yeah, yeah.
Which,
not a dig at them. They literally, that used to be their gig. So,
yeah.
I think for me, what I'm missing is the contrast. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna be a bit rude, but I'm guessing that Einar is not listening to this. Einar, if you are, I apologize. And also, stop listening. Do something better with your time. You're a very talented artist.
Yes.
I spoke to Nick about this, and he was like, okay, I get it. Einar is sad. But can't he be sad and other things as well? For me, what's missing is, like, the contrast. So Coal and Bilateral in different ways are obviously very sad albums, especially Coal.
Yes.
It's all about, like, losing yourself and depression and not being able to trust anyone and your life kind of falling apart and everything. Like, go listen to The Formula or Cloak or Valley or shit like that. Sad music, right?
But like, Contaminate Me, for example, is like angry sad.
Right, exactly. And these other songs as well, none of them hit one note, right? They were all about, like, taking the sadness and thrusting it out into the world with this kind of, like, derision, anger, hope, pain, passion, all these emotions that made it more interesting. And in many ways, the Congregation as well, right? It has a lot of that variety. In Pitfalls' like credit, to its credit, it got rid of the staccato riff that was so annoying on Melina.
They're playing different kinds of riffs now.
Right. They
like
made
more than one kind of riff.
Exactly. They made some steps in the right direction, back to the right direction. And some of the songs on here are genuinely good, like the single that we heard, and have interesting things to say about Leprous. But then a lot of them just feel, you know, like, I don't want to say phoned in, because obviously they weren't, but, like, so monotone and monochrome, right? Same kind of vibe, same kind of palette, same kind of idea as well. Like, they're redundant internally, right?
And the thing is, like, the people in this band are so crazy talented. Bard is like an incredible drummer.
Yeah,
I know, he's an incredible vocalist. Tor is like such a creative guitar player, but like they're just not utilizing it. And it's fine if this is the music they want to make, right? Like I'm fine with that, but it's just like,
so for me,
just makes me sad.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I totally get you. And like, it's not a bad album, but I think for me, also what drew it in really stark contrast is that the new Opeth album fucking kicks ass. It's really fucking good, and I'll tell you why I'm bringing it up, because it's the exact opposite, right? The last three albums were like, whatever, and yep. What I was missing in those albums is what I'm missing on Pitfalls, right? My problem was never, and we spoke about this so many times on the cast, my problem was never with like the artistic direction. My problem was that it was boring. It was just the same style, the same note, the same thing hit. And then this new one in Kaudum, Venerai, whatever, it has dynamics. It has like sad parts and angry parts and fast parts and slow parts and, you know, pretty scintillating vocal parts and more husky, intimate parts. It's like getting the band back almost, right? This creative, virtuose, agile band. And then you go back to Leprous and you remember that they were all those things and arguably better than Opeth at many of them. And now yep. kind of like the fates, you know, when Cole came out, I think I did compare it to Heritage in many ways and totally destroyed it, right? Totally blew mm-hmm. it out of the water. Even if those dates don't like line up exactly, I was listening to them at the same time. And now the tables have flipped, right? Which is kind of weird. So again, like Pitfalls is not, it's not a bad album by any degree, but it's not Cole and it's not Bilateral. And like you said, maybe that's not fair, right? To mm-hmm. judge them by those moments, but we're both, I think, such diehard fans of the band that we yep. can't really help it. But it's a step in the right direction because one last thing, we spoke about this with Gojira. When you check out, right, from mm-hmm. a band, I was ready to go, right? If this album would have tanked, I would have been off the Leprous train. Yeah. And Pitfalls is totally too good for that, right? So mm-hmm. it's giving me hope that there's still something there and still something to be explored.
Yep. I feel like they need to go back to using more distortion in their guitars.
Oh, no, what a surprise, like, that you... No, I'm joking. Yeah, I agree with you.
If you remember Silence in the Snow, which is like the only Trivium album that I actively don't like, like my common complaint about was that it's not that the songs were boring per se, it's just that they didn't play the type of riffs that they played when they did screaming. I don't mind if they don't scream on the album. I'm totally fine with that. But like they didn't play the riffs that they associate with the screaming. And it's kind of the same thing with Leprous. It's not that like distortion inherently is like makes a song better. It's just that the riffs that they tend to play when they have distortion are more interesting than the sad boy things that they're doing on this album, I think.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And like, it's fine as an artist to want to experiment and get tired of your sound and you want to do new things. But at the same time, there's a reason some of your stuff succeeded as much as it did, right? And yeah. and still sounds so good. So there's a lot of experimentation you can do within your parameters, right, of what makes your formula work. And I think here, it's interesting that you brought it up. I actually really agree now that I think about it. It's like the missing keystone, right? Like yep. the arch is there, and all I want is a big fucking riff in the middle of some of these tracks, right? Like yep. just like a big distorted sound, and it's missing. I agree.
Yep. It's lacking big dick energy.
Sure.
Speaking of disappointing Norwegian music.
Oh, Lord.
Like the segue? This is... Yeah.
Yeah, good segue.
So, Borknagar's upcoming album, Up North. No, True North. The song is called Up North.
Yes.
I mean, to be fair, Borknagar have always been, like, all over the place, I think.
Yeah, true.
And I think the... So, this album's kind of meandering. And yeah. I don't know if it's because, like, Vinter Sorg is no longer involved. And maybe, yeah. like, he was kind of the... You know, driving force behind it, but on the other hand, like the new Vinter Sorg album is not that interesting either. Right. So I don't know what's up with that. But I think the appeal of Borknagar was always in like basically the fact that it's a super group, right?
Yeah.
Like just like whatever talent you can throw in there. It's all like this album has ICS Vortex, right? So like I'm going to listen to this no matter what. But it's just that it's a matter of like how much I'm going to enjoy it while listening to it.
But actually, I want to jump in and say that I also find Vortex's performance on this album to be disappointing. I think he uses his voice in a very one note kind of way, and it's kind of a weak way. I keep waiting for ICS Vortex, right?
Yeah.
I keep waiting for some crazy ass kind of thing, and it never really shows up.
ICS Vortex is legitimately incredible.
Amazing, but it doesn't come full on this album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Too bad he's in a his other band is like with a fucking Nazi.
Which one?
Arcturus.
Hellhammer. Oh, yeah, fucking Hellhammer,
sorry, he
man.
Disavowed his anti-Semitism, blah, blah, blah,
fucking
whatever.
Hellhammer, man.
Yeah. I really want to talk about that fucking band because I fucking love Arcturus so much, but
yeah.
I've literally haven't talked about them in like 5 years because Hellhammer is such a huge piece of shit.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah,
what's next?
ICS Vortex is amazing.
Vortex is
like,
amazing.
He needs to make more fucking music, man. Like, yeah. Dude is in like five bands, but he makes like an album every 3 years anyway. Like, what? Make more music, man.
Yeah, work. Yeah. Slave. Don't
yeah,
the,
right? Dance
the
monkey.
Lashable whip.
You know, Bard is in ICS Vortex's solo project, right? Bard from Leprous.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I know.
ICS Vortex's solo album is legitimately incredible. Stormseeker. If you haven't heard it, go check it out.
It's such an underrated fucking release. We gotta do like a hidden gem thing about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
You know what band is like a fucking non-existent, like, what the fuck is this? God of Atheists. You remember that band?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. It's been ages since I thought of
like,
those guys.
And they still haven't like released anything. Like,
yeah.
So God of Atheists is ICS Vortex, Isan, Carl August Tiedemann from... what's the name of that band? God damn it.
I have no idea.
Well, Arcturus, but I'll... he was also in, like, another thing. Winds, I guess. And, yeah. Fucking... Like, this band is, like, basically a super project, right? From... Oh, yeah, Asgeir Mikkelsen from a Spiral... What was that fucking band called, man? Spiral
on,
Architect.
Dude. Yeah, Spiral
no.
Architect, yeah.
God damn it. And like Wintersorg and Isan, like it's fucking
everyone
incredible super project. They teased that they would be making an album in like fucking 2012. And they're still it's still happening, supposedly. It's just that like it's been 7 years. Come on, guys.
Isan's like one of the busiest people on the fucking planet, right? Definitely
yeah.
In metal music. It just keeps working.
Speaking of like projects featuring Isan that's like never fucking happening. The Isan Matt Heafy project.
Yeah, where's that at?
Isan's
that song
too busy.
From Arctis was like one of the best things ever.
Yep. What was it called? Mass Darkness. Yeah,
Mass
that song
Darkness.
Is amazing.
God, I gotta go back to Arctis. Oh, so after I listened to Leprous, by the way, I went back and listened to Celestial Violence. The Isan track that has Einar on it.
Yes.
And Voyager's upcoming album has Einar on it. And he's so fucking good. He's so
Einar's
good.
Incredible.
He's just doing like, again, more of those big ass roles. And it just sounds so good.
Yep.
Okay. You know,
okay, speaking
what,
of like big yeah. ass riffs.
Yeah.
There's a new Despised Icon song out of nowhere.
And we could
Purgatory.
We could have segued to this from Nile because it's again, just a band doing what they're known to do.
Yep.
And doing it well. Like, this is meaty, breakdown heavy, Despised Icon, basically.
Yep.
It's good.
I think it's better than anything off of their previous album.
Yeah, the previous album was, like, serviceable.
Yeah, it's like, it was interesting because they came back.
Right.
But, like, it wasn't too interesting beyond that. I think this one is, like, yeah, this is super good.
Yeah, the... Again, it's just the kind of music that we're not going to tell you that it's like they rewrote the script or whatever, but it just works. The breakdowns are heavy, but not just heavy. You know, they do interesting things with the structure. The vocalist is one of the best vocalists in this genre ever. It just works. You hear
Which
it
one?
And you get pumped. What? The
Which
harsh
one?
Vocalist. What's his name?
They're both harsh, dude. What the fuck?
No, you have this one with a deeper voice, like with the
guttural. Yeah, the guttural guy. Yeah,
exactly. That's what I meant.
I'm kidding. Yeah, Despised Icon is solid.
By the way, did you notice that they dropped like a Sunken Place reference into the track?
Nope.
Like one of the lyrics is, I've escaped the Sunken Place.
I appreciate like modern pop culture references in songs that are like still deep cuts.
Yep.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like how we're like, yep, Despised Icon
yep.
is cool.
Yep. As if nobody knows. Do we want to open the deep dive now? The episode's already kind of long. We can do it next time.
I don't feel like we're just like more or less mostly upbeat in this episode, I think.
Let's keep it going.
Yep.
Tell me why you hated It too.
Oh my god. Fucking
spoilers for It too, I don't know.
I hate these movies. It's part 1 and part 2. I legitimately like don't like them. I think
Before you start, this is the part of the podcast where I don't speak for 10 minutes, guys, so I'll see you in 10 minutes.
Okay. So the It movies fucking suck. Like they suck ass. Like they're bad. So let me explain. Hot take. So there's multiple reasons why they suck ass. Mm-hmm. So first of all, let's just ignore the like wider context of the genre, and let's ignore the whole like adaptation thing, and let's just talk about the movie as like a horror movie.
Yeah. Its own thing.
Literally the whole movie is this one scene repeated over and over. And then it ends. And then there's like this ending sequence, and the scene is a character, one of the characters isolated. They go to like a place that seems normal. They have a flashback to when they were a kid, and ooh, spooky thing with Pennywise happens, and then comes back to the present day. Oh, a spooky thing is about to happen, but wait, if I pay more attention, oh, it was just like a misdirection. It's not spooky, but then I turn back on the reverse shot, and ooh, spooky thing, and then I run away, and then, oh, it's actually fine now, we're good. And then this exact same formula, super, super straight formula, just repeated like, it takes like 5 to 10 minutes each time, by the way. It's repeated over and over, like a dozen times throughout the movie, and that's the whole movie. That's the whole movie.
Sounds amazing.
The scares are mostly like super CGI in like a, not in a good way. Like CGI is just, doesn't blend well with anything. And it's just like stupid. And they are not even like being super creative with it. So it just sucks. Like it's just like a legitimately I was super fucking bored like halfway into the movie, and I actually was like, dude, can I just leave? But like I have a principle of like never leaving movies. It's just like I don't enjoy leaving movies. Like I like seeing them through, even though they're like super fucking bad. And I wanted to see like how it ends, right? Like maybe the ending salvages. By the way, throughout the movie, there's this joke that one of the characters is literally just the Stephen King self-insert, right? Will McAvoy's character. And the whole... constantly
Chris McAvoy.
No, Will McAvoy.
Will McAvoy, okay. I thought Chris McAvoy was in it.
No. No. Chris McAvoy isn't a thing. Will McAvoy. This is the guy from Split and X-Men.
Isn't his name Chris?
No, it's not. It's Will McAvoy.
I'm an idiot. I'm a fucking idiot. I was sure his name was Chris. Okay, Will McAvoy, go on.
His character is like a horror author, and his script is getting adapted to a movie, and like everybody complains about how his endings suck, right? So the movie is like trying to do this cute thing where like, oh, his book's ending suck. This movie's ending fucking sucks, and like that's not lampshading, it's just like bad.
Yeah.
It's just like a really bad horror movie with like a high production value. By the way, the actors are amazing. Like Bill Hader, it's one of his like best roles.
Bill Hader's so good.
Will McAvoy, he's super good. One funny thing is Will McAvoy is like, ever since Split, he's been super fucking buff, and like he plays like Professor Xavier and like this like nerdy author guy with a stutter, and like it's just like they try to hide his buffness with baggy clothes, but like he's so buff that like it just like stands out. It's so funny, and like
that's ridiculous. Yeah,
it just always stands out like how ridiculously jacked the guy is at this point. And like he's just like, I don't know. No, Will, what? It's not Will McAvoy. What the fuck is this guy's name? It's not Will McAvoy either. God damn it.
Wow. Good thing this is not like a cinema.
James McAvoy. We're both James. Wrong. God damn it. You're Will McAvoy is the main character from The Newsroom. God damn it. James McAvoy. What the fuck am I talking about? Okay. James McAvoy and Bill Hader are amazing. Jessica Chastain is kind of okay. She's not given a lot to work with. But I mean, she's good, but it's just that the material is not good, right? I mean, Jessica Chastain is great, but, yeah. And then the one other guy who has like a standout role is, the kid, he used to be fat, but like he grew up to like super hot. The actor's name is, I'm looking it up right now, Jay Ryan, which I don't think he's like, he's
yeah,
been
I don't know the name.
In anything like super interesting, but like that guy has like a bright future. He's like really good.
Awesome.
And the kids are good, right? Especially Finn Wolfhard, the kid from Stranger Things. Yeah. He's really good. Okay. That's like the one good thing about the piece. But like, everything's fucking sucks ass. Like, remember, like, throughout the early 2000s to early 2010s, like, horror movies had this, like, super bad phase where, like, they were extremely generic with, like, bad jump scares and, like, super generic premises and, like, extremely formulaic, and everybody, like, hated the horror movies for that while. This is just that, but with, like, a higher production value and, like, good actors. And like, I don't understand. Yeah, like, I don't understand how people are, like, feeling positively about this or the part one. Part one is the same movie, by the way. Like, this movie is literally just part one, and just like there's no growth, no anything. It just like repeats the exact same sequence of events. So that's the movie on its own, right? But there's this whole other
dimension. there's more.
So as an adaptation of a Stephen King work, right? And by the way, we have the context of the miniseries that was then like the 90s, 80s, whatever, right. With the comedian guy, I forget his name, playing Pennywise. Anyway, so as a Stephen King adaptation, it also fucking sucks because it is like the most surface level reading of Stephen King's work. It's like, oh, it's a creepy clown that scares people and there's a power of friendship and that's it. Like, it doesn't engage with any of the themes. And the problem with Stephen King adaptation is that, like, Stephen King is, like, verbose as shit, right? Like, to a fault. But that also lets him kind of paint a more nuanced world, right? Like, he's not the most, like, deep author, but he just goes, like, he just is very rich. Yeah, he has a rich world, right?
Yeah.
But the movie, it just engages with like the most surface level. It's just a vehicle for set pieces and jump scares. And the things that they choose to take from the book versus change are just so telling. So, by the way, the whole premise of this movie is like unnecessary in a way that in the original work, there's like a time skip, right? And the time skip is there's the kids. And then the time skip, there's the adults. But in this one, they wanted to like bring in the kids as well. So the whole premise of the movie is kind of contrived in that the adults come back, but they have to relive things that they did as kids. So like there's always a flashback, right? So it's this is what they did as a kid. And now here they're doing it as an adult, which doesn't really happen that way in the book. So it's just like a contrivance that already kind of sets it in a like bad place. But then there's like a few other things that they do that is just like really questionable. Like in the book, there is a scene where there's a gay couple and like some people like just like beat and murder one of the gay guys. Like it's a hate crime, right?
Because they're gay, right?
Yeah, it's a hate crime. And like in the book, like this kind of sets up a context. In the movie, it's just there as a shocking opener. It doesn't tie into the rest of the movie. And it's just like, why did you take this part if you're not going to adapt it in here? It just feels like it's there for the shock value. Yeah, it's just gratuitous, right?
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't really engage with any of the themes in the book. So, like, everything it does is, like, super disconnected. And, like, it's, you know, it's about, like, this tight circle of kids who are, like, the circle of friendship, right? But, like, the whole movie is them going off on their, like, individual fetch quests. And there's very little of them being together except for the very beginning and the very end of the movie. So it kind of just like doesn't really engage with that theme in a particular way. And spoilers. In the book, one of the characters, like when he's called back to Derry, he just kills himself. Yeah. And because he's so terrified of it that he can't take it, right? In the movie, they play it off as like this heroic sacrifice. Oh, I'm so scared of Pennywise, so I can't go back. But if I don't go back, you guys will fail in your mission. So I'm doing a big brain move. I'm just going to kill myself so that my absence doesn't, like, you know, break the rules or whatever, right? And then they play it as, like, this heartfelt, weird sacrifice. And it's just so weird and, like, tone deaf. And it's just, like, played as this, like, heroic moment. But it's just, like, glorifies his suicide in a really weird way. And again, it doesn't tie up thematically. It's just bizarre and like
sick a bit.
Tone deaf. And then at the end of the movie, how they defeat Pennywise is by bullying him. Because, you know, these kids were like bullied and the whole reason that they got together was bullied. So it would be poetic for them to like bully Pennywise to death, right? Because that tells them like bullying's actually good, right?
That's ridiculous.
What the fuck? Like, it's just like so tonally bad. And like, by the way, the previous movie by the director was like Mama, which was also like a super generic shitty horror movie. Yeah. Which brings me to the third reason why this movie's bad is that it just completely like ignores everything that's been happening in the horror genre. Like, I talked about this a little bit, right, in the a bit before, where like the whole movie just like is the throwback to like when horror movies were at their worst, and like it learns nothing from that. It's just like extremely generic jump scares executed in an extremely predictable fashion. If you go back like 5-10 years, like James Wan has completely reinvented the like jump scare genre, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not even comparing it to like highbrow horror movies like The Witch or It Comes at Night or Babadook or whatever, like those, or even It Follows, like this kind of more subversive horror, right? I'm even comparing it to like the Blumhouse style horror. Like,
right.
They have just like evolved the genre.
New techniques. In a way,
yeah, new techniques, new, you know, new camera styles, new pacing, new musical cues, like new things to kind of keep it fresh. And this just doesn't do any of that. And it's just like so basic and bad. And it's just like insulting to horror genre. Like, it's just made by a person who doesn't have a love for the horror genre and doesn't respect the audience. It's just fucking trash ass movie in every single way other than the production values. Like, the actors are amazing, but like everything else, like, what the fuck is this movie? It's just like, earlier this year there was a Pet Sematary remake and I really hated it, right? Like, it was just really bad. But like, this is worse in a way because they have more money and more like hindsight, because it was already adapted once. I mean, Pet Sematary was adapted once, right? But like they had just more to go off of, and they still just like dropped the ball,
botched
so
it
hard. It's just like, it's no better than the Pet Sematary remake, which was panned, and this should be fucking panned too. It's like an insulting movie in like every way. It's a waste of time. It's 3 fucking hours long, and it has no need to be. It's just that they wanted to have more and more set pieces, but there's no reason for these set pieces to exist. The only reason that one would go to see this movie is like Bill Hader and James McAvoy, Will McAvoy is amazing in this. Like,
yeah,
but like, it's not worth your time for that. It's 3 hours long, and like, it's just a trash movie. Fuck this movie. I hated it so much.
I think this is a good segue into Scanline.
Yeah.
So if you aren't familiar with Scanline, it's a co-production between Harris.
Harris B. Bream, what was the guy's name? H. Bomber Guy.
And Shannon is her name, right? The person who does Scanline with him?
I think so.
She edits and also is featured in it. They literally made a point about it being a joint project. So let me just get the name right. Shannon.
Yeah, Shannon Strucci and Harry Brewis.
Right.
H. Bomber
Guy. Yeah. So Scanline is like the, you know, series within his channel focusing on cinema and them being huge nerds and like ranting about cinema. And they do like episodes very infrequently. And when they do, it's great. Honestly, it's like my favorite content of his. I think it's much better than anything else he does.
Except for the Lost video. That is just a Mike Knowles.
Right, the Lost video is a masterpiece. I totally agree. And he also references it in this Scanline episode. And this episode of Scanline is about the director's cut. And it's a very interesting episode about a very interesting topic. And one which I feel like is very close to what we talk about on the podcast. You could hear like the echo of the same conversation about authenticity in music, right?
In authorial intent.
Right, exactly. Authorial intent, the death of the author, authenticity, and technical issues and stuff like that. So this is also a recommendation to go and watch the latest episode of Scanline, and in general, H. Bomber Guy, and specifically Scanline, the previous episodes. But also, I think it's a really interesting discussion. I thought we could like maybe talk about it for a few minutes.
I want to call out, like, I mean, I knew this before, but like, hopefully H. Farmer Guy's video and Shannon's video kind of gets more eyes on the fact that, you know, one of the most praised director's cuts of all time is Blade Runner, which, you know, original movie was kind of shaky, and then the director's cut made it good. But the funny thing is, normally the director's cut is viewed as like, oh, you know, studio meddling, then this the true vision of the director. Right. No, Ridley Scott was a fucking hack, and like this director's cut was made by the studio, and like that's how it actually became a good movie.
I think the most interesting point they made in this video is the idea of how capitalism kind of takes your desire for authenticity and then sells it back to you. So you start with this subversive thing of like he says in the video, right? Like Orwell is like super, Orson Welles, sorry, not Orwell, Orson Welles, is like, he's an auteur and he does what he wants and he's radical. And Ridley Scott is like, get your hands off my movie, blah, blah, blah. But then now you go online and you see that everything has a director's cut and you just pay another ticket. Like you did to go see Midsommar, right? We spoke about it last week. Was it really necessary? No. Did they get a few more bucks out of it? Sure. So all these questions of like authenticity and commercialism and stuff like that. And I think it's super interesting that the movie at the center of this discussion is Blade Runner, a movie about authenticity, reality, what it means to be a person, what it means to be authentic. And also, I don't feel like he stressed it enough in Scanline, the irony of Rutger Hauer's improvisation, right? Like we talk about when he says very correctly, like, why is the director like the final say? A movie is literally made by hundreds of people. I feel like the most accurate example would have been, did anybody ask Rutger Hauer whether he wanted the director's cut? Like he arguably made the fucking movie. Like, it's really hard to overstate how much that final scene makes Blade Runner.
The two best lines from It Part 1 were improvised by the kids. One of them is, let's kill this fucking clown, which became like the kind of tagline of the movie, was improvised by one of the kids. And also the gazebo joke where instead of placebo, the kid says gazebo, in like a totally serious setting. That one was also improvised by the kid.
Awesome. So like, he has like ethereal authority here, right? Like he's an author of those lines and they're super important to the piece. I really enjoyed the movie. It brought up a lot of interesting things. It also reminded me that I need to watch the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven. I did ages ago and I remember not being that impressed, but I've seen a lot of movies since then and I kind of have a different taste now. And I was always in favor of Orlando Bloom. He's very disparaged, but I kind of enjoy a lot of his stuff.
I'm really interested in seeing his new Amazon show that's like a high Carnival fantasy thing. Yeah.
Yeah, Ronnie started watching it because she thought she was going to hate watch it. Because it looks super generic and like Harry Potter knockoff or whatever. But she actually enjoyed the first episode and we're going to watch it together. So I'll let you know how that goes. She said it's not incredible, but it's done really well.
I feel like the H. Farmer Guy video is kind of negative on director's cuts, but I think it's kind of also does have some merit in that some movies, like not every director's cut is worthwhile, but some movies that are just like too much for the, you know, cinema audience do need a director's cut. Like the, you know, the classic examples, like the Lord of the Rings movies, right? They're like, they would be, they're already super fucking long and they would be way too long, but the director's cuts like actually add legitimate content. So there is some value in it, but it's been like monetized and memed out way too much, and you have to be like approach it at a case by case basis. And of course, hashtag release the Snyder cut.
Oh my god, so bad. And going back to like Blade Runner, I think it was also a good example because it's such a classic elitist, pretentious white guy telling you, well, did you watch the final cut? Because that's the only version worth watching. It's like so non-nuanced.
Yeah, because like the movie wasn't like a classic for like 20 years before the final cut came out, right?
Right, and I totally agree that the final cut is superior. But the original movie is still good. One movie that he didn't bring up, which I was surprised he didn't bring up, is Dune. That was a complete disaster, and then David Lynch made the director's cut, and it was an even bigger disaster. And it was like 5 hours long or something. And I actually watched it on VHS, and it fucking sucked. It was so bad. I mean, the original is also bad, but the director's cut was even worse. It was like all these scenes that like expand on parts of the book that are really not important to the storyline when you're doing it in the movie. Like a lot of dialogue between the doctor and the Mantat and whatever is just terrible. And I feel like all of those forces were replayed because it's David Lynch, right?
You know what's way. Okay, let's recommend some good director's cuts. Because yeah. Like I got one. There is a director's cut of The Hateful Eight by Tarantino.
I've seen Netflix.
They added a bunch of scenes and made it into a 4-part mini series, which I think is how that movie should have been. Like, it's too long to be like a single movie, but as a mini series, it's super good. And I watched it, and like the stuff that's added is meaningful in the sense that, you know, it's long, but it just kind of sets the tone, right? And yeah. I think that's like a good example. The director of It wants to release, he wants to film additional scenes and release a supercut of the two movies as one like 6-hour thing. I'm sure that will be hot garbage. Do not watch that.
So I'm going to meme it up and I'm going to recommend the director's cut of Southland Tales. I think I've spoken about this movie before. It's batshit insane. It was made by Richard Kelly, who made Donnie Darko. Hmm. And it was like entirely disparaged when it aired at Cannes. It was 160 minutes long. And it was re-edited and shortened when it was released. And it's still, I will die on this fucking hill. It's still a good movie. I spoke about it on the cast, but if you don't remember, The Rock plays a prophetic screenwriter who's written The End of the World. And what's his name? The Stifler. What's the guy's name?
Sean Michael Scott?
Sean Michael Scott plays the Messiah, but he's a security guard. And Justin Timberlake is a PTSD suffering sniper. And a bunch of insane, it's like science, weird science fiction. It's awful and amazing. And the director's cut is even better. It like connects a lot of the scenes, and but you gotta like that strand of weirdness and like off-kilter shit. But I would recommend checking out the director's cut just for the experience, right? It's an experience.
All right, I'm literally buying it right now.
Awesome.
Let me try to think of another.
Well, I mean, I can't recommend the final cut of Blade Runner enough, right? Like,
it is
a classic example of really like the voiceover and redoing the CGI, not the CGI, the effects and some of the settings. It really is a masterful movie, and the final cut is the way to consume it, right?
Yep. For Star Wars, the fan cut, I think, is the original Star Wars trilogy. It's probably the best way to consume those movies. Like, where
I was thinking of you when you kept doing the fake out to George Lucas.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a joke that you would do, like taking it too far.
apparently Sucker Punch is a director's cut. Don't watch that.
Don't. Oh my God. One of the things that I'm most shameful for is that I used to enjoy that movie. Now when I watch it, I'm like, ah, fucking Zack Snyder.
Yeah, that movie is a testament to why the Bechdel test is not good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't consider that. I mean, again, sorry to be like a cliche nerd, but the Lord of the Rings director's cut are genuinely great.
Yeah.
They do, especially Fellowship of the Ring, because, you know, Fellowship of the Ring is the best movie of the trilogy, right? Even without the director's cut. I fully believe
Fellowship
that.
Fellowship is the first one?
The first one, yes.
I actually like the third one.
Return of the King is also good.
I guess it's kind of good by the virtue of structure, right?
Yeah, it does a lot of callbacks and resolution stuff like that. Yeah, right? Yeah. But Fellowship has that like unbridled wonder to it and energy. And mm-hmm. there's a very visible cut where there was more stuff, right? After mm-hmm. Moria, it just kind of fast forwards and then everything gets resolved and the movie's over by. And in director's cut, there's like more Rivendell. And there's more stuff in Moria, and it's really fucking good. The director's cut for Helm's Deep, for Two Towers and Return of the King is also really good, but the first one is where it really shines.
Also, another, like, small brain recommendation is Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, he didn't like the director's cut for that.
Yeah.
Right?
Whatever.
Wait, that was the joke?
No. I mean, it's I think still improved by the like there's also like multiple cuts of that one. I don't remember like which one is like the good one, but like just look it up. Cool. Whatever. All right.
Thanks for listening.
No. Just let me just real quick.
More thing. Oh yeah. Sorry. You got the other side of YouTube.
If you want to watch a good genre movie instead this week, go watch Don't Let Go. So Don't Let Go. Have you seen Frequency?
Yes.
You like Frequency?
I did.
If you like Frequency, you'll like Don't Let Go as well. Don't Let Go is a movie about this detective. His brother's family, aka his brother, the brother's wife, and the brother's daughter get murdered. And he, you know, it kind of destroys his life, right? But mm-hmm. then he gets a phone call from his dead niece, and he quickly figures out that the dead niece is calling from 2 weeks ago before the murder, which is like 3 days before the murder, right? And he tries to use this information to figure out the murder and also prevent it. And it's a cool premise. I mean, same premise as Frequency, right? Instead of like 20 years, it's like 2 weeks. But it's like really well done. Like it's shot well. The acting is great. And, you know, a lot of movies do like time travel premises, but most of them botch it. but this one, it's fully consistent and executed well. And the thing is, like, it's not about time travel. It's about characters, right? It stars David Oyelowo in the leading role, and he's great. And also the brother is played by Paperboy from Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
And Alfred Molina is in it, by the way. And it's just, like, super good. Like, it's the premise, obviously, like, if you've seen Frequency, you've seen this one, but it's super good. Like, it's, yeah, I love it. It was great. I had a great time. It was kind of predictable, but also kind of unpredictable in some ways. And it was just a good time, right? Like, I was surprised by how well executed it was. And by the way, I'm going to shout out, you know, Blumhouse Productions, which do a bunch of these horror movies. This was on, like, Blumhouse's sub-label BH Tilt, which I think is their, like, more kind of low budget but more indie kind of things, right? It like they do, what was it, they did the Creep movies with Mark Duplass, which are super good, by the way. Have you seen those?
Which one?
Creep.
No, I haven't.
It's on Netflix. I highly recommend you watch it. It's made like written, directed by, and starring Mark Duplass, and
oh cool,
he plays this like maybe serial killer guy who just like, it's like a two-person movie, and the sequel's also a two-person movie, but they're like really, really good. I recommend them highly. So basically BH Tilt is their like kind of more experimental label, but even on their main label, like Blumhouse has been killing it. Like they do both like lowbrow and highbrow horror, right? Yeah. They've done Happy Death Day, they do the Insidious movies, they did Get Out, they did The Belko Experiment. They do the Purge movies. They do everything. They're like super, super good. They started out as like just doing like trashy horror movies, but they've since evolved. Then. Yeah, they did Us as well, I think. And they've evolved to doing like both highbrow and trashy horror movies. And I am a big, big fan of Blumhouse. Like Jason Blum is like the dude has this. Kept the horror genre alive. Like he has revitalized the horror genre. They did Paranormal Activity. Like these guys are the reason why horror is still big. And like shout out to Jason Blum. Hope he doesn't turn out to be a piece of shit.
That's sadly likely, I would say.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, shout out to Blumhouse. And A24, obviously. Blumhouse and A24 obviously. Are like my favorite studios right now.
Sweet.
All right.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Wrap around.